Before I start the show, I just wanted to acknowledge my newest patron, Kev. Kev is my new stone dog. Thanks so much, Kev. Really appreciate your help.
Stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 26th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. All units have converged on the rendezvous point. The people of the dragon have come. Yet another evil entity has a city in its grasp. Yes, it's time for the stone to fall. Today's topic is the ending of The Dragon Reborn. Prepare for me to hardcore fangirl about Robert Jordan's writing.
With all of the criticism that I have leveled at The Dragon Reborn while exploring it over the past 8 episodes, I hope I haven't given the impression that I dislike this book, because nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's a great book. It has so many strengths interwoven through its weaknesses. Perhaps it's more accurate to say that it just has a handful of weaknesses that take away from its strengths. But they don't take that much away, because in my opinion, Book 3 is one of the most entertaining books in the series. The Dragon Reborn shines when it comes to pacing and the general building of the narrative. The character development that he does for Perrin, Matt, and Egwene is really top-notch and also makes the book stand out, but the pacing and the snowballing acceleration of the action makes the story so exciting that it is a book that I always enjoy reading. The flaws stand out because I'm trying to read these books critically, and I will acknowledge them when they come up, but nonetheless, whenever the time comes to begin Book 3 once more, I'm always like, let's go, let's read this book again, because it's so much fun. And what I think I like best about it is the ending. It is so good. There is this sense of sweeping, rising action and a gritty, well-paced climax. It is so well written, with rapid POV changes and continually increasing tension, a sense of danger and fun combat scenes. It's got it all. And there are things that don't make sense because there's just stuff he hadn't totally ironed out. He hadn't ironed out all the rules, and because he didn't know how many volumes the series was going to be, he could not properly imagine it, and I grant him a lot of leeway for that, partly because I know what it's like to write something and not settle into the story until you're a good ways in, and I can imagine what it would be like to not be able to go back and fix it. Having to publish in volumes takes a special kind of bravery, and I don't know that I could do it. Well, because I don't even have the bravery to publish the first time. I'm too much of a perfectionist. All I can do is have the courage to criticize someone else's work. So however much I point out flaws in The Dragon Reborn, never let it be said that I don't think it's a terrific book. It's wrapping up the original story, the limited one that he had based upon how many books he had approved, and it opens the door on something new. Robert Jordan can shed the stuff that wasn't working. He can shed the shared dreams, and he can shed the mushier bits of magic and start working on a much harder system with much more defined rules, now that he has the space and breathing room to actually dedicate to building that world as well as telling the story. And he gets to basically start fresh. The Shadow Rising will be a new story with a completely different flavor and much greater possibilities. RJ ends The Dragon Reborn, letting us know that Rand and his friends' journeys are really only now beginning. We thought that we had been in the midst of this, but it's like, no, you've only been in the prologue. They've been doing their side quests, and they've been earning their experience points, and only now is it time to start the main mission. And you see that with the prophecy that he ends the book with. It says, and it was written that no hand but his would wield the sword held in the stone, but he did draw it out like fire in his hand, and his glory did burn the world. Thus did it begin. Thus do we sing his rebirth. Thus do we sing the beginning. And that's brilliant, to end it with a prophecy that flat out tells people the story is just getting started. If you thought you knew the story, time to break it to you. You didn't know, and you're going to get something so much deeper and so much better in the next book. When I first read The Wheel of Time, because I started it in the winter of 1992, I actually thought, in reading the climax of The Dragon Reborn, that this was the last battle. When I was reading The Eye of the World, I thought it was a standalone book, and as I said in my first episode, I think, I had the ending spoiled for me because I was walking through the store one day, and I saw a book called The Dragon Reborn, and pulled it off the shelf and read Randall Thor's The Dragon Reborn, and because I was 15 and a dumbass, I didn't even realize that Rand was the dragon, and so I was like, wait, what? Regardless, with the discovery of three, I thought I had a trilogy here. My copy of The Dragon Reborn did not say that there were any more books. It was that early into the series being out, so as I read the next to last chapter, I was confused. Rand's like, I'm the Dragon Reborn, and I've killed Shaitan. I will end all the killing and destruction, and everything will be sunshine and puppies forever and ever. And I was just kind of like, that was so small, you know, after all of the terror and all of the stress and the strain and everything, it was a very anticlimactic last battle. What a letdown. And then I read the final chapter, where the characters are reflecting upon the death of the Dark One, and it's like, if you were a first-time reader and you didn't have the back of the book to tell you that, no, there are indeed 11 more books to go, you learned in real time, along with the characters, oh no, this isn't the end. In the final chapter, Matt, the girls, and Moraine are in a room in the stone with Rourke. Matt is asking questions about what exactly happened. If the stone won't fall until the people of the dragon come to tears, is that us? And Rourke volunteers that if a man goes to Roydian to become a clan chief and he survives, then he comes out with a dragon on his left arm. And it says, the Aiel are the people of the dragon. Moraine spoke quietly, but she sounded as close to startlement as Matt could remember ever hearing her. That I did not know. Then it really is all done, Matt said. Just as the prophecy said, we can all go on our way with no more worries. The Amarylline won't need me to blow that bloody horn now. How can you say that? Egwene demanded. Don't you understand the Forsaken are loose? Not to mention the Black Aja, Nynaeve added grimly. We took only Amigo and Joya here. 11 escaped, and I would like to know how. And the light alone knows how many others there are that we do not know. Yes, Elaine said in a tone just as hard. I may not be up to facing one of the Forsaken, but I mean to take pieces out of Leandrin's hide. Of course, Matt said smoothly, of course. Are they crazy? They want to chase after the Black Aja and the Forsaken? I only meant the hardest part is done. The stone has fallen to the people of the dragon, Rand has Kalendor, and Shaitan is dead. Moraine's stare was so hard that he thought the stone shook for a moment. Be quiet, you fool, the Aes Sedai said in a voice like a knife. Do you want to call his attention to you, naming the Dark One? But he's dead, Matt protested. Rand killed him. I saw the body. And a fine stink that was, too. I never thought anything could rot that fast. You saw the body, Moraine said with a twist to her mouth. A man's body, not the Dark One, Matt. He looked at Egwene and the other two women. They appeared as confused as he. Rourke looked to be thinking of a battle he had thought was won and now learned had not even been fought. Then who was it? Matt demanded. Moraine, my memory has holes big enough for a wagon and team, but I remember Balzamon being in my dreams. I remember. Burn me, I do not see how I could ever forget, and I recognized what was left of that face. You recognized Balzamon, Moraine said, or rather the man who called himself Balzamon. The Dark One yet lives, imprisoned at Shale Ghul, and the shadow yet lies across the pattern. The light illumine and protect us, Elaine murmured in a faint voice. I thought the Forsaken were the worst we had to worry about now. Are you sure, Moraine? Nynaeve said. Rand was certain, is certain, that he killed the Dark One. You seem to be saying Balzamon was not the Dark One at all. I don't understand. How can you be so sure? And if he was not the Dark One, who was he? I can be sure for the simplest of reasons, Nynaeve. However fast decay took it, that was a man's body. Can you believe that if the Dark One were killed, he would leave a human body? The man Rand killed was a man. Perhaps he was the first of the Forsaken freed, or perhaps he was never entirely bound. We may never know which. And then Egwene mentions that Varen had shown her that piece of paper and that Balzamon was very likely Ishamael. So I remember reading that and feeling relieved because I was like, okay, well, that makes a lot more sense. And that means that this last battle isn't totally weak. And also then thinking, wait, don't tell me that there's not another book out yet. Don't tell me I have to wait to find out what happened. That will be fucking horrible. And so because this was before the internet, or at least before normal people had regular access to it, or I had never even heard of it, I had to go to the library and use their intranet to look up Robert Jordan, and it just so happened that there was a book called The Shadow Rising that the library had in paperback, and so I was able to find out what happened, at least for one more book. And I read those first four books over and over again for months until The Fires of Heaven came out, and I am grateful. I am so fucking grateful that I didn't have to leave it with, it's not the last battle, but what's gonna happen next? The climax of The Dragon Reborn kicks off in chapter 49, which is called A Storm in Tyr. RJ uses the titular storm to sync up time or events as our heroes are all converging on the city, the final time that they are all gathered in one place. I was going to say the final time until they gather at the Fields of Marilor, but I just listened to A Memory of Light again and they don't actually all gather in the same place at the last battle at the same time, all of them together ever. The girls arrive first, beating Matt by several hours. They go to Alyuan Gwenna's house because Nynaeve doesn't want to stay at an inn, and Alyuan tells them, hey, I've got a thief catcher who can help you find these women. And Julin Sandar comes and tells them, yeah, I'll totally help you, but you'll want me to do it quick because there are thieves skulking around on the rooftops, and so I know that I'm going to get called to the Stone of Tyr to deal with it. And this lets us know that despite the fact that the girls had horses and a riverboat, Rourke, Avienda, and all of the rest of the Aiel are in Tyr the same day, if not before. Come nightfall, the girls settle down to do some dreamwalking before bed. RJ, through this final sequence in The Dragon Reborn, gives us alternating POVs from all of the Emmonsfield Five, and he makes sure to stoke tension with each perspective switch. It's just like bam, 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 and each time it changes, he shifts it up another gear. So Egwene is doing her dreamwalking to see if she can find anything out about the Black Aja, and it's like Jordan's done playing around. He has her start in her little field of butterflies because that's the only way she knows how to make the world of dreams work right now. But immediately she closes her eyes, opens them in the heart of the stone, and she sees the Black Aja gathered around Kalendor, and Leandrin looks at her and smiles. It says, gasping, Egwene sat up in bed so fast she almost fell off the side. What is the matter? Elaine demanded. What happened? You look frightened. You only just closed your eyes, Nynaeve said softly. This is the first time since the very beginning that you've come back without us waking you. Something did happen, didn't it? She tugged her braid sharply. Are you all right? How did I get back? Egwene wondered. Light, I do not even know what I did. She knew she was only trying to put off what she had to say. Unfastening the cord around her neck, she held the great serpent ring and the larger twisted Tirangriel on her palm. They are waiting for us, she said finally. There was no need to say who, and I think they know we are in Tyr. Outside, the storm broke over the city. RJ does this great job of ending with that super ominous line. He's building this wonderful sense of dread. And then we switch to Matt, and the first paragraph immediately syncs the time between him and the girls as he and Tom arrive, because the storm has broken over the city. It says, rain drumming on the deck over his head, Matt stared at the stones board on the table between him and Tom, but he could not really concentrate on the game. So Matt's ship is docking in Tyr. He's basically come from Camelin to Arengil, all the way downriver, pressing for speed because he is desperately afraid that Komar is going to manage to kill the girls. So he and Tom plan to get an inn and immediately go out and start looking for Komar or the girls, one or the other. So they're walking through the mall and into the city proper, and they pass Mother Gwenna's shop, and it says, lightning streaked across the sky, three jagged bolts together, casting a stark light over a narrow house that seemed to have bunches of herbs hanging in the windows. And we can assume that this is at the very least a few minutes after Egwene comes back from Tel Iron Riad, because there has to be time for the rain to have been falling for a bit. Tom and Matt, the minute that they get out of the mud and hit the pavement of Tyr's inner city, take rooms at the first inn that they find, and they proceed to start their search by questioning the innkeeper. It says,
Of a big man with a white streak in his beard, he knew nothing, nor of three women meeting the descriptions Matt gave. Matt left everything but his cloak and his quarterstaff in his room, barely looking to see that it had a bed. Sleep was enticing, but he refused to let himself think of it, then wolfed down a spicy fish stew and rushed back out into the rain. He was surprised that Tom came with him. "I thought you wanted to be in where it's dry, Tom." The Glee Man patted the flute case he still had under his cloak. The rest of his things were up in his room. "People talk to a Glee Man, boy. I may learn something you would not. I'd not like to see those girls harmed any more than you." There was another inn 100 paces down the rain-filled street on the other side, and another 200 beyond that, and then more. Matt took them as he came to them, ducking in long enough for Tom to flourish his cloak and tell a story, then let someone buy him a cup of wine afterwards while Matt asked around after a tall man with a white streak in his close-cut black beard and three women. He won a few coins at dice, but he learned nothing, and neither did Tom. He was just glad the Glee Man seemed to be taking only a few sips of wine at each inn. Tom had been close to abstemious on the boat, but Matt had not been certain he would not dive back into the wine once they reached Tyr. By the time they had visited 2 dozen common rooms, Matt felt as if his eyelids had weights. The rain had lessened a bit, but it still fell steadily in big drops, and as the rain fell off, the wind had freshened. The sky had a dark gray look of coming dawn. "Boy," Tom muttered, "if we don't go back to the White Crescent, I am going to go to sleep here in the rain." He stopped to cough. "Do you realize you've marched right past 3 inns? Light, I am so tired I can't think. Do you have a scheme of where to go that you have not told me?" Matt stared blearily up the street at a tall man in a cloak hurrying around a corner. "Light, I am tired. Rand is 500 leagues from here playing at being the bloody dragon." "What? 3 inns? They were standing almost in front of another, the golden cup, according to the sign creaking in the wind. It looked nothing like a dice cup, but he decided to give it a try anyway. "One more, Tom. If we don't find them here, we'll go back and go to bed." Bed sounded better than a dice game with 100 gold marks riding on the toss, but he made himself go in. 2 steps into the common room, Matt saw him.
So Rand is also in Tyr. We don't know if he arrived before Matt, before the girls, whatever, it doesn't matter, and he's wandering around. Matt sees him before he goes into the Golden Cup, and Rand ends up looping back around or something, because he comes back up the street and walks in front of the inn, passing in front of the door. Matt is dicing with Komar, and as he throws the weighted dice, he wants to look at the door, and that's because Rand is walking past, and his Tavirin tugging makes the weighted dice come up all 6s. And so then Matt threatens Komar, and then he proceeds to kill him after Komar tries to stab him. And it's exciting. You get nice action in the fight with Komar, and it's also just nice because he's such a shitbag, so it's nice to see him get what he deserves. RJ manages to mix together these bits of commotion and fun and humor and tension and ominous mood building, and it's just perfectly paced and perfectly combined and really masterfully written. So after Matt kills Komar, they go back to their inn and go to bed, and it says, "Dawn was not long in coming, but Matt rousted himself out of bed, and he and Tom set off trying to search every inn inside the walls of Tyr. Matt let himself wander wherever the mood in the next turning took him, not looking for inns at all and tossing a coin to decide whether to go in. For 3 days and nights he did this, and for 3 days and nights it rained without stopping, sometimes thundering, sometimes quiet, but always pouring down. Tom's cough grew worse, so he had to stop playing the flute and telling stories, and he would not carry his harp out in that weather. He insisted on going along, however, and men still talked to a Glee Man. Matt's luck with the dice seemed even better since he had begun this random wander, though he never stayed in one inn or tavern long enough to win more than a few coins. Neither of them heard anything useful. Rumors of war with Ilion, rumors of invading Mayenne, rumors of invasion from Andor, of the sea folk shutting off trade, of Ardor Hawkwing's armies returning from the dead. Rumors the dragon was coming. The men Matt gambled with were as gloomy about one rumor as the next. They seemed to him to hunt for the darkest rumors they could find and half believe them all. But he heard not a whisper that might lead him to Egwene and the others. Not one innkeeper had seen women matching their descriptions. So I'm assuming that Matt's luck is better because he's wandering to random inns and tossing coins to decide whether or not to go in. But he can't find the women because they're not at an inn. So I'm assuming that by tossing the coin, his luck is determining whether or not he'll win if he goes into that particular inn. But the whole setting that RJ is writing as he's describing Matt's 3 days wandering around searching for the girls is tense. There's something about omnipresent rain that builds atmosphere. It's like the pouring rain evokes that drumming similar to the dice that Matt comes to have in his head. And Tom's cough and his deterioration builds anxiety. But the audience can also know with Tom's cough that if it gets bad enough, he's going to need a wisdom eventually, and that's going to lead Matt to the girls, and then it's just a question of will it lead him there in time. And then RJ adds to the urgency with the rumors and how men are just so gloomy, and he also talks about how Matt's having dreams. And I don't care for the dreams because they're a plot hole and an inconsistency, but he does use them to great effect throughout The Dragon Reborn before he must have realized, wait, they're a terrible plot device, it's illogical, only Aes Sedai shield their dreams and they're a bare fraction of the channelers in the world, too many plot holes, cancel, abort, abort. And the danger when you publish something in volumes like that is you can't go back and change it. And given the choice between continuing on with it because powerful channelers broadcasting dreams is part of the canon of Book 3, or pretending that it's not a thing because he realized that it wasn't a logical plot point, I think that choice number 2 is the best choice to go with. And I understand feeling frustrated at the lack of consistency, but it's just a risk that you're going to run if you're reading a piece of work that is being refined as it goes along, and it just is what it is. And the dreams, while they're in effect, are used to great effect, to build the atmosphere that carries the rising action. And it all adds to this increasing desperation that Matt feels to find and protect these people that he cares about from now mysterious enemies. He has killed Komar, and learned in the process that other people are looking to kill the girls. Before, he's like, I want the guy with the stripe in his beard, and now he only knows that, hey, somebody's looking for them, and I have to find them. And Jordan does a great job of making him seem genuinely nearly frantic. We switch to Perrin, and we know that it's probably the next day because they cross the river into Tyr, and it says, Puddles stood on the steaming stones of the dock. Try to say that 5 times fast. So presumably the following afternoon, Matt said that it rained for 3 days, so now it's stopped, water is evaporating, and RJ takes advantage of this little bit of lull in the action while bringing our last group of characters onto the scene and into the city to build a little bit of tension or dread. It says, the huge shape of the Stone of Tyr lay off to their left, shadowed so that it looked like a mountain despite the great banner at its highest point. He did not want to look at the stone, but it seemed impossible to look at the city without seeing it. Is he here yet? Light, if he has already tried to get into that, he could be dead already, and then it would all be for nothing. We know that Rand has been in Tyr for 3 or 4 days, and we don't know what he's been up to during that time. I'd guess that he's just kind of been wandering around and doing some scouting, trying to figure out exactly how to get into the stone, and also just affecting the pattern. Not necessarily intentionally, but affecting the pattern nonetheless. Perrin and crew go into the city, and when they get to their inn, and the innkeeper takes them up to their rooms, Perrin kind of notices that Moraine, who, as I discussed in the last episode, has been struggling with serenity for the past little while, is looking kind of preoccupied. It says, staring off at nothing, she worked her cloak in her hands almost as if wiping them, unaware what she was doing in Perrin's opinion. How did we go about finding Rand? He asked, but she did not appear to hear him. Moraine? Remain close to the inn, she said after a moment. Tyr can be a dangerous city for those who do not know its ways. The pattern can be torn here. That last was soft, as if to herself. In a stronger voice, she said, Lon, let us see what we can discover without attracting attention. The rest of you stay close to the inn. So RJ uses Moraine's increasingly, I guess erratic is a reasonable term. If a person is Aes Sedai and is expected to maintain calm in situations of extreme stress, then it's fair to say that Moraine's behavior has been increasingly erratic. He uses it as a device to build tension, because the more desperate she gets, the more desperate the story feels. It is so unlike her to have those kind of strong emotions. It's so unlike her to behave in a way where she would be twisting her cloak and staring off into space. So her tension and her anxiety is bound to rub off on others. Her whole being and presentation is one of serenity. So having Moraine pushed to the edge like that is such a clever way for RJ to use a character and the changes in the character's behavior to set the tone. And he does that very well throughout the series, particularly with Rand. The worse Rand gets and the scarier he gets, the more effectively RJ is able to use his personality traits and his presence to set tone. So then we get the blacksmith scene in Dermot Ajala's smithy, which I actually really like. I think it's a quiet moment and it's really nice. And if you would like to support my Patreon, I have minisodes at the $6 level if you want to come and be a night spear. And I actually have one where I talk a bit about this blacksmithing scene and what I like about it. It's just a little lull in the storm and this final piece of Perrin's puzzle or his characterization. He gets his hammer, and it's like he's learning that he has options and choices for who he is, and that nothing is inevitable. He can shape himself. When he comes back to the inn after working in the blacksmith shop, Moraine and Lon have learned about Baelal being in charge in Tyr. One main plot hole, how does she know it's specifically Baelal? Who the fuck knows? Anyway, Moraine admits, hey, I don't know very much about Baelal. And that's one of the things I appreciate about Moraine, is she always is willing to admit her ignorance. Anyway, she's like, Loial, do you know anything? And Loial tells her the little that he knows. He was called the Netweaver. He was called the Envious. He envied Lanfear and Ashamael as well as Luthaeron. And Moraine's like, okay, I'm convinced. He wants to kill Rand and steal Kalendor. And so Perrin says, if he is inside the stone, if he's waiting there for Rand, we must go inside to reach him. How do we do that? Everyone keeps saying no one enters the stone without the permission of the High Lords, and looking at it, I don't see any way but through the gates. You do not go in, Lon said. Moraine and I will be the only ones to enter. The more who go, the harder it will be. Whatever way in I find, I cannot believe it will be easy even for only two. Guiding, Moraine began in a firm voice, but the warder cut her off with one just as firm. We go together, Moraine. I will not stand aside this time. After a moment, she nodded. Perrin thought he saw Lon relax. The rest of you had better get some sleep, the warder went on. I have to be out studying the stone. He paused. There is a thing that your news drove out of my head, Moraine. A small thing, and I cannot see what it might mean. There are Aiel in Tyr. Aiel? Loial exclaimed. Impossible. The entire city would be in a panic if one Aiel came through the gates. I did not say they were walking the streets, Ogier. The rooftops and chimneys of the city make as good a hiding as the waste. I saw no less than three, though apparently no one else in Tyr has seen any of them. And if I saw three, you can be sure there are many times that I did not see. It means nothing to me, Moraine said slowly. Perrin, why are you frowning in that way? He had not known that he was frowning. I was thinking about that Aiel in Remen. He said that when the stone falls, the Aiel will leave the threefold land. That's the waste, isn't it? He said it was a prophecy. I have read every word of the prophecies of the dragon, Moraine said softly, in every translation, and there is no mention of the Aiel. We stagger blindly while Baelal weaves his nets, and the wheel weaves the pattern around us. But are the Aiel the wheels weaving or Baelal's? Lon, you must find me the way into the stone quickly. Us, find us a way in quickly. As you command, Aes Sedai, he said, but his tone was more warm than formal. He vanished through the door. So that's a good little scene. It builds that sense of looming adversity. You know, it's so dangerous that only Lon and Moraine can even risk trying to get into the stone. In fact, she doesn't even want to bring Lon along because it's so dangerous. But he won't let her go alone. They're going to go in and fight together. Very little builds tension more than a Forsaken. Forsaken are scary. Having Samael be in Ilion and all of them being like, oh fuck, we've got to go. That was tense. The whole scene in Ilion when they have to flee and then they're being chased by the Dark Hounds in the rain, that is a stressful and thrilling scene. And now we are in Tyr and it's just sort of like, oh shit, here is another ancient evil entity who is intent on our utter destruction. And it's just danger, danger. And it's really good. It's a really good tension. Less than 24 hours later, we are in Nynaeve's head, and her chapter starts out, from the corner of her eye, Nynaeve thought she glimpsed a tall man with reddish hair and a swirling brown cloak well down the sunlit street, but as she turned to peer from under the wide brim of the blue straw hat Al-Ewan had given her, an ox-drawn wagon was already lumbering between them. When it lurched on, the man was nowhere to be seen. She was almost certain that had been a wooden flute case on his back, and his clothes were certainly not Taran. It couldn't be Rand. Just because I keep dreaming about him does not mean he's going to come all the way from Almoth Plain. So just a little check-in with Rand, and then right afterwards a guy carrying a basket of fish trips and his fish all land nose first in the mud, just a way to say Rand was here. So he's just been kind of floating around the city for the last few days, stirring up the cauldron. This Nynaeve point of view is some of the best writing in the book, I think, and I've discussed that before in my episode about Egwene. I mostly focused on Egwene's characterization in the story because she is one of the main focuses of The Dragon Reborn, but RJ does do a little bit of characterization of Nynaeve too. She only has two POVs in this book. She has one in the tower where she's waiting for Swan Sanche to check in on them so she can tell her, yo, the Black Aja went to Tyr and we need to follow, and then this one where Julin Sandar comes and finds her and brings her back to Ayu and Gwenna's house. But RJ manages to do almost all of Nynaeve's character development in just a few well-written paragraphs in this second point of view. We see some actual growth. We see her processing her relationship with Egwene, which, like I said, I covered in the episode about her. He's also showing her strain, and she's raging in her head about the Black Aja and how she's going to drag them all down. And she defaults to hating on Moraine, which is always kind of her go-to hate. But earlier on, in her previous point of view, when they're working in the kitchen because they're being punished for having run away from the tower, and she's having her snarled inner narrative, which is basically that's Nynaeve, as having a snarled inner narrative full of self-delusion and anger and anxiety, I've come to understand. And it says how she doesn't like that she can channel, but she has to learn if she's going to get back at Moraine. And it says, hating Moraine for what she had done to Egwene and the other Emmons Fielders, pulling their lives apart and manipulating them all for Aes Sedai purposes, was nearly all that kept her going. And it's like, she acknowledges in this later chapter in Tyr as she's hating on Moraine and basically saying she'll pull the Black Aja down and everything and she will triumph and make everyone pay. She acknowledges that it's not really logical that she's hating on Moraine, and it's like, if it's all that's keeping her going, then Nynaeve is far more overwhelmed and traumatized by the stuff that she's been through over the last year than she would ever understand, because she lacks the self-awareness or the desire to even probe her own motivations or understand herself. She's lost control. She left the Two Rivers to protect the kids, and then that spun out of control so fast, and it's all that keeps her going to hate Moraine, because if she didn't have that focus, then she would fall apart, I guess. And that speaks to a tremendous anxiety, an anxiety that might be absolutely crippling if she could bring herself to acknowledge it. And so maybe her lack of self-awareness is a strength in its own way, or a coping mechanism. But this chapter, chapter 51, Bait for the Net, which is an entire Nynaeve chapter, it shifts the climax into the next gear, because now we get action that comes with dire consequences. Julin Sandar finds her and is like, oh hey, you gotta come back to Mother Gwenna's house, and betrays her, and Nynaeve is a fucking badass, and punches Leandrin in the face, and smacks Rihanna, and the whole, I think that they know that we're in Tyr, they know that we're here, has become, they found us. And that is just next level dread. And that chapter ends with this ratcheting up because the girls are carted away. Our next group of heroes have found their way into the stone, but bad news, because Leandrin tells them 13 Murdrel are coming and they're like, oh fuck, because that is the worst thing ever. And then we switch to Matt. And Tom's cough has gotten horrible enough that it's like the pattern is shifting things into place. It's like, okay, Matt, time for you to find out that you need to get into the Stone of Tyr too. You've got to go to Mother Gwenna's house and find out that the girls were there. It says, the innkeeper had given simple directions, but when they reached the gate and faced the mud of the mall, Matt almost turned back to ask after another wise woman. There had to be more than one in a city this size. Tom's wheezing decided him. With a grimace, Matt stepped off into the mud, half carrying the Glee Man. He had thought from the directions that they must have passed the wise woman's house on their way up from the dock that first night, and when he saw the long narrow house with the bunches of herbs hanging in the windows right next to a potter's shop, he remembered it. Lopar had said something about going to the back door, but he had had enough of mud. And the stink of fish, he thought, frowning at the barefoot men squelching by with their baskets on their backs. There were tracks of horses in the street, too, just beginning to be obliterated by feet and ox carts. Horses pulling a wagon, or maybe a carriage. So, that syncs up the time. He sees the horse tracks, but they've had some time to be wiped away. When he finds out from Alu and Gwenna that, hey, the girls were here, he learns that they left just a little under 3 hours before, and that they were taken to the stone. And he's like, okay, well, I can't take Tom with me because he's so sick he can barely walk. So he offloads him onto Mother Gwenna, which is just another moment of humor and fun interspersed between all the tension and the fear. And that's one of the things that makes Matt so great in this book, is that he's just really fun, and he puts levity and energy into the story, which he does a lot. It's really a defining characteristic that makes Matt a wonderful character. So he offloads Tom, and Tom gets threatened with being tied to a bed by his cloak if he doesn't comply and do what Alu and Gwenna tells him to do, and the chapter ends, and it says, "Ahead of him, the Stone of Tyr loomed over the city, impregnable, a fortress besieged 100 times, a stone on which 100 armies had broken their teeth, and he had to get inside somehow, and bring out 3 women, somehow. With a laugh that made even the sullen folk in the street look at him, he headed back for the White Crescent, uncaring of mud or the damp heat. He could feel the dice tumbling in his head." This is the first time that Matt hears the dice. And the dice are a method to automatically bring a sense of tension. When you're in Matt's POV and you hear them, it's like, oh shit, something momentous is going to happen. And you could argue that it's an overused device, but I don't agree, because it's funny. It's a funny device because it torments Matt. Once he gets to the point of realizing whenever the dice rattle, they're letting me know that something shitty is going to happen or something consequential is going to happen. And Matt's internal narrative of constant wanking means that even if it's a neutral thing, he's going to complain about it and make it out to be terrible, because any possible fate except something that he chooses for himself is absolutely horrible. And so because the dice in his head torment Matt, they're funny. Jordan almost always employs them with some manner of humor, so while they do build tension and they do let you know, oh no, some shit is probably going to go down, it's always kind of fun because Matt is anxious about the dice, so it's entertaining to wait with him and be like, when are they going to fall? When are they going to fall? What's going to happen? And then if something momentous happens and it doesn't make the dice stop, then you're like, oh shit, something else is going to happen, something even bigger. And because you get to exist in his head while he delights you with his exaggerated complaining and melodramatic raging against fate, the dice are extremely entertaining. But the dice are almost secondary here, because in these 2 paragraphs that he ends this chapter with, he's using words like loom, the Stone of Tyr loomed, and imagery like broken teeth, armies broke their teeth. So the rising action has already been given the next turn of the crank. The language alone has made the suspense increase. It's just a perfect opportunity to introduce this next piece of Matt's abilities. So then we switch to Perrin, and he's had a second day of blacksmithing, and RJ is basically at this point keeping him occupied. He keeps him occupied in the smithy, and then he will occupy him in Tel Iran-Riad too. He's mostly done with what he wants to do with Perrin in this book, so giving him a task that combines foreshadowing, a little bit of world-building for Tel Iran-Riad, and he uses it for time-syncing as well, because throughout the final rising action and the climax, both Rand and Egwene will be spending time in Tel Iran-Riad, and so having Perrin there to more or less ring the gong, he hits his hammer against things while he's searching for Fy'eel, something that both Egwene and Rand are able to hear, and that sinks time, and it's a good enough use for him. So Perrin works at the smithy all day, and Fy'eel eye-fucks him the whole time, and then they're coming back to the inn, and Moraine and Lon meet them at the front, and it says, "Rand is in Tyr." The Aes Sedai's cool voice issued from the depths of her hood as from a cavern. "Are you sure?" Perrin asked. "I've not heard of anything strange happening. No weddings or wells drying up." He saw Zareen frown in confusion. Moraine had not been forthcoming with her, and neither had he. Keeping Loyal's tongue silent had been more difficult. "Don't you listen to rumors, blacksmith?" the warder said. "There have been marriages, as many in the last 4 days as in half a year before, and as many murders as in a whole year. A child fell from a tower balcony today, 100 paces onto stone paving. She got up and ran to her mother without a bruise. The first of Mayenne, a guest in the stone since before the winter, announced today that she will submit to the will of the High Lords, after saying yesterday she would see Mayenne and all its ships burn before one Terran country lord set foot in the city. They had not brought themselves to torture her, and that young woman has a will like iron, so you tell me if you think it might be Rand's doing. Blacksmith, from top to bottom, Tyr bubbles like a cauldron." "These things were not needed to tell me," Moraine said. "Perrin, did you dream of Rand last night?" "Yes," he admitted. "He was in the heart of the stone, holding that sword." He felt Zareen shift beside him. "But I have been worrying about that so much it is no wonder I dream of it. I had nothing but nightmares last night." "A tall man?" Zareen said, "with reddish hair and gray eyes? holding something that shines so brightly it hurts your eyes, in a place that is all great redstone columns? Blacksmith, tell me that was not your dream. You see, Moraine said, I have heard this dream spoken of 100 times today. They all speak of nightmares. Baelal apparently does not care to shield his dreams, but that one above all else. She laughs suddenly like low, cool chimes. People say he is the dragon reborn. They say he is coming. They whisper it fearfully in corners, but they say it. And what of Baelal? Perrin asked. Moraine's reply was cold-drawn steel. I will deal with him tonight. There was no fear sent from her. This is great atmosphere, and it increases the pressure. The dragon is coming. The Forsaken will be dealt with. Shit's gonna go down, and it's gonna go down tonight. Moraine tells them, hey, you guys have to go to Tar Valon, and Fael runs up the stairs, and she falls into the hedgehog trap. Moraine is like, too bad, so sad. Perrin, you've got to go to Tar Valon. And Perrin is like, how about fuck you? I'm going to follow after her. And the focus is just kind of on the value that he places on Fael, which will be a continuing theme throughout the rest of the series as he is obsessed with finding her when she is kidnapped and in Malden. And I feel like Brandon Sanderson in finishing up Perrin's arc does a good job of making all of that not be utterly frivolous. He uses Perrin's trauma and his fixation on Fael to help him master the world of dreams, and to make it so that in the last battle, when Perrin doesn't know where she is because the caravan with the horn gets hijacked into the Blight, and everybody knows that she's probably dead, he doesn't let himself get distracted with that. And I feel like if he hadn't lost her first in Tel Iron Riad, and then later on for a much longer period of time with the Shido, and had to deal with that trauma and those emotions already, he would not have been able to compartmentalize and prioritize and do what needed to be done in the last battle. And loving my wife the way that I do, I understand the power of his emotions. I can't imagine feeling those emotions for Fael, but I do understand feeling those emotions for a person and feeling those emotions for your wife. The tension ups, though, because Perrin leaps into the dream. And the nature of this particular dream is utterly unknown. Moraine's like, I don't know exactly what happened to her. I don't know where she went, but she's probably gonna die, and I can't guarantee your safety or what's gonna happen to you if you go there. I've told you everything I can, and I think she's fucked, but you know, do what you want, because I can't stop you. You've proven to me endlessly over the course of the last several weeks that I can't stop you. And I can only regain my serenity if I accept what I cannot change. I gotta go now. Good luck. Hope you don't die. So we smash cut to Matt. And it says at the very beginning of the chapter, the rooftops of Tyr were no place for a sensible man to be in the night. Which is just, once again, great setting, right away. Not even the first full sentence. Rooftops in the night. You're skulking. It all screams high stakes. So Matt is up there and he is carrying his diversionary bundle that he's made for himself, and he's got the means of making fire, and he has scouted the whole wall, and now he's planning his entry. It says, the sides of the stone looked like cliffs. Eyeing the height again, he told himself he should be able to climb it. Of course I can, just like those cliffs in the Mountains of Mist. Over 100 paces straight up before there was a battlement. There must be arrow slits lower down, but he could not make them out in the night, and he could not squeeze through an arrow slit. 100 bloody paces, maybe 120. Burn me, even Rand would not try to climb that. But it was the one way in he had found. Every gate he had seen had been shut tight and looked strong enough to stop a herd of bulls, not to mention the dozen or so soldiers guarding very nearly every last one in helmets and breastplates and swords at their belts. Suddenly he blinked and squinted at the side of the stone. There was some fool climbing it, just visible as a moving shadow in the moonlight and over halfway up already, with a drop of 70 paces to the pavement under his feet. Fool, is he? Well, I'm as big a one because I'm going up too. Burn me, he'll probably raise an alarm in there and get me caught. We've had it told to us already that Rand is good at rock climbing, but I'm wondering if he spent the 5 days that he's been in Tyr wandering around looking for any other way in before deciding, fuck it, I'll just climb up the side. Matt's original plan here is to stuff the fireworks into the arrow slit to create a diversion, and he's anticipating that he's just going to get a loud bang and a lot of light, and he's figuring, okay, that'll distract people, I can climb up, get over the top, and then be inside, and everybody will be drawn to the arrow slit, and he's not thrilled at the idea because it's a terrifying climb. And Rand was the one who did the scariest of the rock climbing when they would go, probably because it was easier for him because he was taller. Taller and had better reach. But then, Matt comes across the Aiel and Julin Sandar, who is struggling to work against compulsion and conditioning. And I feel like, despite Leandrin's trick, her compulsion isn't really very good, and Julin is normally a strong-willed enough person, but his conditioning as far as his perception of the High Lords of Tyr and Terran classism and their social structure in general gives him this twisted view of High Lords being able to do no wrong that is such that Leandrin was probably able to lay enough of a seed of doubt, being like, hey, you know that we come from the High Lord Salmon. We couldn't possibly be thieves. These women must be lying. They couldn't have been honest with you. Did you think that they were really honest with you? Why would they be looking for us? And just sow the seed of doubt enough, since he's not an idiot. He would have to know that they were using fake names, which would allow for a foundation of suspicion, and then she could just hit him with the compulsion, but he knows deep down that it's wrong. And he's also such an upstanding guy that he's really confrontational about the fact that there are all of these people up on the fucking roof where they don't belong. He recognizes Aiel, because if you read his backstory in the Wheel of Time Companion, he's in his late 30s, and he fought in the Aiel War as a basic foot soldier when he was basically a kid around Faiel's age. But anyway, so he comes across the Aiel, and when he comes across Matt, and he's just kind of like, yeah, I'm skulking around because I know I did something wrong and I feel shitty about it. And it says, one of the Aiel nodded and spoke with the older man's voice. I am Rourke of the Nine Valleys Sept of the Tardad Aiel, and once I was Ethan Dor, a Red Shield. Sometimes the Red Shields do as your thief catchers do. I say this so you will understand that I know what it is that you do and the kind of man you must be. I mean no harm to you, Julin Sandar of the Thief Catchers, nor to the people of your city, but you will not be suffered to raise the arm cry. If you will keep silence, you will live. If not, not. You mean no harm to the city, Sandar said slowly. Why are you here, then? The stone. Rourke's tone made it plain that was all he meant to say. After a moment, Sandar nodded and muttered, I could almost wish you had the power to harm the stone, Rourke. I will hold my tongue. Rourke turned his veiled face to Matt. And you, nameless youngling, will you tell me now why you watched the stone so closely? I just wanted a walk in the moonlight, Matt said lightly. The young woman put her spear point to his throat again. He tried not to swallow. Well, maybe I can tell them something of it. He must not let them know he was shaken. If you let the other fellow know that, you lost whatever edge you might have. Very carefully, with two fingers, he moved her steel away from him. It seemed to him that she laughed softly. Some friends of mine are inside the stone, he said, trying to sound casual. Prisoners. I mean to bring them out. Alone, nameless one? Rourke said. Well, there doesn't seem to be anyone else, Matt said dryly. Unless you care to help. You seem interested in the stone yourself. If you mean to go into it, perhaps we could go together. It is a tight roll of the dice any way you look at it, but my luck runs good. So far, anyway. I've run into Blackfield Aiel, and they've not cut my throat. Luck cannot get much better than that. Burn me. It would not be bad to have a few Aiel along with me in there. You could do worse than betting on my luck. We are not here for prisoners, gambler, Rourke said. It is time, Rourke. Matt could not tell from which of the Aiel that came, but Rourke nodded. Yes, Gull. He looked from Matt to Sandar and back. Do not give the arm cry. He turned away, and in two steps he had blended into the night. So, Matt decides against going up over the wall because Julin Sandar tells him, hey, I know this special gate where a thief catcher can bring a prisoner in, so if you want to team up with me, you can pretend to be my prisoner, and we can get into the stone that way. I know exactly where these women who are prisoners are held, and I'll take you to them. And so Matt's kind of like, well, okay. You know, he decides that he'll team up with Julin, even though he doesn't really trust him, because it's a hell of a lot better than climbing up the wall. But he's worked really hard on his diversionary tactic, and he wants to add to the confusion, and also he just wants to know what's going to happen when he lights off all the fireworks at once, because who wouldn't? It says, with the tin box dangling from one hand by its wire handle and his quarterstaff held horizontally in front of him, Matt took a deep breath and started toward the stone. He tried not to think of how far it was to the pavement below. Light, the bloody thing is 3 feet wide. I could walk it with a bloody blindfold in my sleep. 3 feet wide, in the dark, and better than 50 feet to the pavement. He tried not to think about Sandar not being there when he came back, either. He was all but committed to this fool notion of pretending to be a thief caught by the man, but it seemed all too probable that he would return to the roof to find Sandar gone, maybe bringing more men to make him a prisoner in truth. Don't think about it. Just do the job at hand. At least I'll finally see what it is like. As he had suspected, there was an arrow slit in the wall of the stone right at the end of the wall, a deep wedge cut into the rock holding a tall, narrow opening for an archer to shoot through. If the stone were attacked, the soldiers inside would want some way to stop any trying to follow this path. The slit was dark now. There did not appear to be anyone watching. That was something he had tried not to think about, too. Quickly he set down the tin box at his feet, balanced his quarterstaff across the wall right against the side of the stone, and unslung the bundle from his back. Hurriedly he wedged it into the slit, forcing it as far as he could. He wanted as much of the noise to be inside as he could manage. Pulling aside a corner of the oiled cloth revealed knotted fuses. After a little thinking back in his room, he had cut the longer fuses to match the shortest, using the pieces to help tie all the fuses together. It seemed they should all go off at once, and a bang and flash like that should be enough to pull everyone who was not completely deaf. The lid of the tin box was hot enough that he had to blow on his fingers twice before he could pry it off. He wished he had whatever Ludra's trick had been, lighting that lantern so easily, to expose the dark bit of charcoal inside, lying on a bed of sand. A wire handle came off to make tongs, and a little blowing had the coal glowing red again. He touched the hot coal to the knotted fuses, let tongs and coal fall over the side of the wall as the fuses hissed into flame, then snatched up his quarterstaff and darted back along the wall. "This is crazy," he thought as he ran. "I don't care how big a bang it makes. I could break my fool neck doing this." The roar behind him was louder than anything he had ever heard in his life. A monstrous fist punched him in the back, knocking all the wind out of him even before he landed, sprawled on his belly on the wall top, barely holding onto his staff as it swung over the edge. For a moment he lay there, trying to make his lungs work again, trying not to think how he must have used up all his luck this time by not falling off the wall. His ears rang like all the bells in Tar Valon. Pushing himself up carefully, he looked back toward the stone. A cloud of smoke hung around the arrow slit. Behind the smoke, the shadowed shape of the arrow slit itself seemed different, larger. He did not understand how or why, but it did seem larger. He only thought for a moment. At one end of the wall, Sandar might be waiting, might be intending to take him into the stone as a pretend prisoner, or might be hurrying back with soldiers. At the other end of the wall, there might be a way inside without any chance of Sandar betraying him. He darted back the way he had just come, no longer worrying about the darkness or the drop to either side. The arrow slit was larger, most of the thinner stone at the middle simply gone, leaving a rough hole as if someone had hammered at it with a sledge for hours, a hole just big enough for a man. How in the light? There was no time for wondering. He pushed through the jagged opening, coughing at the acrid smoke, jumped to the floor inside, and had run a dozen steps before defenders of the stone appeared, at least 10 of them all shouting in confusion. Most wore only their shirts, and none had helmet or breastplate. Some carried lanterns, some held bared swords. Matt was kind of a dumbass here, since the point was to call attention to this place where he just decided to walk in, and he acknowledges that as he begins to fight, but it's too late to fix it, and fortunately, Julin Sandar arrives in time to keep Matt from being killed. Matt learns about his luck in this book, and he also learns the awesome power of explosives. Starting in Book 7, we hear that he is looking for an illuminator, and I can only conclude that after blowing a hole in the stone, he began to, whenever he saw a walled town or city, and started daydreaming how to attack it, as is his nature, or as it becomes once he gets the memories in his head, he would look at it and think how to use explosives to breach the wall. So I think he was looking for an illuminator originally with the idea of using the fireworks with sappers, and maybe also having his grenadiers flinging dynamite with slings like they do starting in Book 11. And then Aludra comes along and she's dreamed up the idea of casting the bronze lofting tubes and actually inventing cannons. She's like, yeah, sappers and grenadiers are useful and cool, but let me show you artillery. Explosions make everything more exciting. And so now we've reached the turning point. Everybody is in the stone. Rand just climbed over the wall. Lon is sneaky and subtle and finds his and Moraine's way in off-screen. The girls went to Tyr planning to spring a trap, so while being captured and brought into the stone in the manner in which they did wasn't exactly the plan, they're now inside nonetheless. Perrin is in the stone in the world of dreams, which is kind of his forte and foreshadowing for how he will spend the last battle doing important things in Tel Iron Riad. And then we have Matt blowing a hole in the Stone of Tyr as a diversion, and then foolishly deciding that said diversion was the best way then to get inside, which means that he's fighting from here on out. So it feels like, at this point, the horse that is the ending of this book is starting to gallop. Next, we finally check in with Rand. It says, "The alarm gong sent echoes crashing through the stone, but Rand paid no more attention to them than he had to the roar that had come before, like muffled thunder from somewhere below. His side ached. The old wound burned, strained almost to tearing by the climb up the side of the fortress. He gave the pain no heed either. A crooked smile was fixed on his face, a smile of anticipation and dread that he could not have wiped away if he had wanted to. It was close now, what he had dreamed of. Kalendor." So he is working his way down because the explosion came below him. It's very shortly after the explosion that Matt describes in his narrative the alarm gongs going off, and Matt tells us that the wall is only 3 stories high, so it's quite a ways below, and Rand is just working his way down. Next, we're in Egwene's head. She wakes up and wants a situation report, and Nynaeve tells her, "One of them is sitting outside. A Miko, that milk-faced chit, if they've not changed since we were thrown in here. I suppose one is enough to maintain the shielding once it has been woven." She barked a bitter laugh. "For all the pains they took and gave to take us, you would think we were of no importance at all. It has been hours since they slammed that door behind us, and no one has come to ask a question or look or even bring a drop of water. Perhaps they mean to leave us here until we die of thirst." "Bait." Elaine's voice quavered, though she was obviously trying to sound unafraid and failing miserably. "Leandrin said we are bait." "Bait for what?" Nynaeve asked shakily. "Bait for who? If I am bait, I'd like to shove myself down their throats till they choke on me." "Rand." Egwene stopped to swallow. Even a drop of water would be welcome. "I dreamed about Rand and Kalendor. I think he is coming here. But why did I dream of Matt and Perrin? It was a wolf, but I'm sure it was him." "Do not be so afraid," she said, trying to sound confident. "We will escape them somehow. If we could better the Seanchan, we can best Leandrin." Nynaeve and Elaine exchanged looks over her head. Nynaeve said, "Leandrin said 13 Mardrel are coming, Egwene." She found herself staring at that message scratched on the stone wall again. "The light have mercy and let me die." Her hands clenched into fists, her jaws cramped with the effort of not screaming those words. So that's dark. And I love Egwene's characterization in this because it's sort of like, that's dark, but it's also logical and understandable. Because, yeah, being turned to the shadow is horrible, and we don't see that happening really until the very end of the series, but you don't need to see it to know that it's not good. But then Egwene feels her purse and finds that they didn't take her stone ring, and she's like, okay, well, let me see what I can do. She goes in to tell Iron Riad, and she finds Joya Bayir there. She attacks and shields her, and she starts beating her with flows of air, and it says, "You will remember this and feel it when you waken, when I allow you to waken. Remember this, too. If you ever even try to beat me again, I will return you here and leave you for the rest of your life." And Egwene says a lot of this stuff just to frighten Joya. I don't think she really gives it much thought, so it doesn't occur to her that she is saying things to Joya that are perfectly within her capacity. They aren't empty threats. She doesn't yet get the level of power that her will provides in the world of dreams. But Egwene decides that while she doesn't feel bad about beating the shit out of Joya, she does feel bad about taking the time out to do it when Elaine and Nynaeve are languishing terrified in the dungeon, and after some consideration, she determines that indeed, no, she will not have the set flows of air beat the shit out of Joya until she allows her to awaken, because while she might be an asshole, she's not a sadistic asshole. And then she makes her way down to the dungeon to try to figure out a way to escape. Then we switch to Perrin in Tel Iron Riad. He's got limited time. Hopper told him that he was here too strongly and that he'll die, but there's nothing he can do about it, so Hopper is helping him look for Faile. They've been fighting through obstacles, including Defenders of the Stone who have been kidnapped and brought into the world of dreams against their knowledge and consent. Perrin finds Faile wrapped in chains, and she fades away before he can rescue her, and he's super pissed off about it because he's like, "I fucking found her!" And Hopper says, "The dream is not like the world of flesh, young bull. Here the same hunt can have many endings." He did not turn to look at Hopper. He knew his teeth were bared in a snarl. Again, he raised the hammer, brought it down with all his strength against the chains that had held Faile. The stone block cracked in two under his blow. The stone itself rang like a struck bell. So, basically, a bit of world-building about Tel Iron Riad. shows us some of the ways in which it can be used, and lets us know, hey, you know, nothing here is necessarily set in stone. And once again, RJ uses characters to set tone. Perrin's obsessiveness about Faile lends itself to a tone of desperation, and that accentuates the climax, even if what Perrin is doing is not actually important in the overall fight, it's only important for him personally. The other narratively useful thing that Perrin does at the end of this book is work as a time sink in Teleron Riad. He runs around the world of dreams looking for his girlfriend and pounding his hammer to keep time, so that we're able to tell when we're in Rand's POV or when we're in Egwene's POV exactly where the time syncs up because they hear a bang. But the strangeness of the world of dreams and the fact that Perrin is still so new to it adds to the general atmosphere of trepidation, and it works. Even if it's kind of like, here, let's have Perrin spin his wheels, which Perrin spends a good bit of the series doing in his own way. But still, it works. Then we switch to Matt, fighting and barely managing to defeat the High Lord Darlan. The city wall that the arrow slit was on was 3 stories high. I'm assuming he's made his way down 1 floor, because I figure that the High Lords are not on the 1st floor of the stone, and it says, Matt gave a start and peered down the hall, where a man had just gone trotting across along adjoining corridor. Burn me, if I did not know it was crazy, I would swear that was Rand. We don't know how many stories are in the Stone of Tyr, but I'm assuming quite a lot, and Rand has managed to just kind of slip his way down as Matt has been fighting. It says that he fought Darlan for 5 minutes, and he fought defenders on the floor above. He's been occupied for some time with combat. RJ writes really great fight scenes, and being in Matt's head, especially for fights, is a lot of fun because he thinks tactically, and he's also humorous. You know, he's humorous, he's exasperated, but in the end, Matt, despite all of his wanking, has an oddly positive attitude about things, partly, weirdly enough, because he's so melodramatic, and it's just one of the things that makes Matt fun. And then you get back to Rand. And now, it's finally he's reached the artifact that has been taunting him this whole time. And Baelal comes out in villain monologues, and there's this sword fight, and Baelal is like, take Kalendor, and I'll give you a chance. And Rand's like, I don't think so. So it says,
he met the Forsaken with the sword he knew. The blade of fire wrought with Sidene, and was driven back. The falling leaf met watered silk. The cat dances on the wall met the boar rushes downhill. The river undercuts the bank, nearly lost him his head, and he had to throw himself inelegantly to one side with black flame brushing his hair, rolling to his feet to confront the stone falls from the mountain. Methodically, deliberately, Baelal drove him back in a spiral that slowly tightened on Kalendor. Shouts echoed among the columns, screams, the clash of steel, but Rand barely heard. He and Baelal were no longer alone in the heart of the stone. Men in breastplates and rimmed helmets fought with swords against shadowy veiled shapes that darted among the columns with short spears stabbing. Some of the soldiers formed a rank. Arrows flashing out of the dimness took them in the throat, the face, and they died in their line. Rand hardly noticed the fighting, even when men fell dead within paces of him. His own fight was too desperate.
So this is fun and exciting too, because it's chaos and sword fighting and all of the fun anxiety of Rand feeling uncertain because once again, he's not good enough with the sword yet. And also the battle has finally made it to the heart of the stone and everything has made it into the heart. And then Moraine comes in and she just stops Baelal. She walks in and she's like, no, you don't get to slay the dragon. He's like, fuck off, I thought I had dealt with you. It says, Moraine had not stopped or slowed while he spoke. She was no more than 30 paces from him when he moved his hand and she raised both of hers as well. There was an instant of surprise on the Forsaken's face and he had time to scream, no! Then a bar of white fire hotter than the sun shot from the Aes Sedai's hands, a glaring rod that banished all shadows. Before it, Baelal became a shape of shimmering motes, specks dancing in the light for less than a heartbeat, flecks consumed before his cry faded. So, we've had anticlimactic Forsaken Zorching before, and this feels the same, kind of like when Aghanor. It says in the Wheel of Time Companion that Rand kills Aghanor at the Eye of the World, that he burns him up, but the impression that I get from reading it is that Aghanor burns himself out using the power in the Eye, so I don't know if that's just a mistake or what. I operated under the assumption that what it says in the Wheel of Time Companion is correct when I did my episode The Breast of the World, but either way, it was a very anticlimactic death of a Forsaken. Even Balthamel being killed wasn't very exciting. So we've had that before, just, well, that Forsaken is dead, and Baelal's death feels a lot similar. But no, here we've got a boss battle within a boss battle, because Ishamael has been waiting in the wings. And I'm assuming since Baelal is jealous of Ishamael, we've had those dreams where Perrin has seen them, and Ishi is yelling at Baelal and yelling at Raven, and I'm assuming that he's been waiting in the wings this whole time for Baelal to kill Rand, and then once he does, planning on zorching Baelal so that he cannot get Kalendor, because I can't imagine Ishamael would for a second let Baelal have it. Why else is he waiting in the shadows? So that after Moraine kills Baelal, she gets grabbed by the One Power and tossed off by Ishamael. But then Rand grabs Kalendor. It says, "The One Power surged through him, a torrent greater than he could believe, from Sidon into the sword. The crystal blade shone brighter than even Moraine's fire had. It was impossible to look at, impossible any longer to see that it was a sword, only that light blazed in his fist. He fought the flow, wrestled with the implacable tide that threatened to carry him, all that was really him, into the sword with it. For a heartbeat that took centuries, he hung, wavering, balanced on the brink of being scoured away like sand before a flash flood. With infinite slowness, the balance firmed. It was still as though he stood barefoot on a razor's edge above a bottomless drop, yet something told him this was the best that could be expected. To channel this much of the power, he must dance on that sharpness as he had danced the forms of the sword." So, I'm assuming that Baelal figured that he would be able to kill Rand while Rand was struggling with that initial flow. He planned to balefire him or whatever, and kill him while he was struggling with the surge, and then grab Kalendor. Because it seems like a pretty ballsy move to be like, "Here, draw out this most powerful Sangreal, and then I'm going to kill you." That seems ambitious. Regardless, Ishamael, the minute that Rand grabs Kalendor, is like, "Oh shit," and he flees in to tell Eärendil in the flesh, and Rand follows after. And then you're back to Egwene. It says, "The stone shook under Egwene's feet." The stone shook. It rang. She caught her balance and stopped listening. And so that's Perrin pounding his hammer on empty chains in frustration because Faile vanished. Egwene is heading into the dungeon, and RJ here shows us a really good example of unintended consequences when it comes to somebody who is self-taught or has learned at least a little bit of the One Power and then has to extrapolate on her own how to do something or has to just learn by watching people. She comes upon Aniko Nagoyan, who has shown up in Tel Eärendil because she's playing around with her dream Tirankriel. And it said, she knew it was possible to cut a woman off from the true source even if she had already embraced Sidar, but severing a weave already established had to be much harder than damming the flow before it began. She set the patterns of the weaving, readied them, making the threads of spirit much stronger this time, thicker and heavier, a denser weave with a cutting edge like a knife. The wavering shape of the Dark Friend appeared again, and Egwene struck out with the flows of air and spirit. For an instant, something seemed to resist the weaving of spirit, and she forced it with all of her might. It slid into place. Aniko Nagoyan screamed. So she didn't mean to still her. There's no intent there. But I think there's a continuity issue here, because Egwene finds Joya by year first when she shows up in Tel Eärendil, and when she shields Joya, it says, Egwene reached for Sidar again, wove the complicated flow of spirit as she remembered it being used against her, and cut Joya by year off from the source. So, she had already successfully shielded someone who was holding the power. I'm not sure why she needed to make a sharp edge to do it better a second time. According to the Wheel of Time companion, Aniko is stronger than Joya, but not by much. It's like a strength level of 15 to 16, and Egwene is a plus 5, which is another continuity issue. Neither of them are strong enough, according to later canon, to hold a shield on all three of them. Perhaps not even strong enough to hold a shield on one of them alone. After she stills Aniko Nagoyan, Egwene wakes inside the cell, and Elaine and Nynaeve are like, "Yeah, we're still shielded." It says, Egwene formed the emptiness inside her, became the rosebud opening to Sidar. The invisible wall was still there. It shimmered now. There were moments when she almost thought she could feel the true source beginning to fill her with the power. Almost. The shield wavered in and out of existence, too fast for her to detect. It might as well have still been solid. And this is also a continuity issue, because it seems like if Aniko was holding on to all three shields, they should vanish once she stilled. And if the shields are tied off, then they shouldn't have changed once she's stilled. So I feel like this is just a thing where RJ hadn't quite figured out what he was doing, particularly because once they're released and rescued and Ninety punches Amiko in the face and knocks her unconscious, then they're able to reach the One Power. But we get what amounts to our falling action for the girls and Matt. He comes into the dungeon and Amiko's sitting there. She's been stilled and she's wrapped in air, and Julin's like, oh shit, she's one of the bad ones. And, you know, it's like Matt does rescue them, but they also rescue themselves, because if Egwene had not taken care of Amiko in Tel Iron Riad, Matt would have died when he went into the dungeon, so they are equally responsible for their own rescue. And eventually, the shields on them would have unraveled, so they could have technically gotten out on their own. But who knows how long it would have taken? And intent and thought count a lot, so the fact that Matt tried so hard to rescue them means something, and they are dicks to him about it. But at the same time, he is really presumptuous and kind of sexist, and for the most part, we have to tell ourselves the rest of the story as far as the five of them, because the girls are like, yeah, we're not leaving, when Matt says, hey, we need to get the fuck out. They say, no, we're going to go find Leandrin, we're going to find Joya Bayer, we're going to kick all of their asses. And Matt is finally like, okay, well, I'm not going to let them die after I put in all this effort. And so he follows them with Jewel and Sandar. And you hear from Matt in the final chapter. He's asked a question, and they're all staring at him, and it says, burn me, break them out of a prison cell, save their lives half a dozen times between them before the night is done, and they glower as hard as the bloody Aes Sedai. And that lets us know that they must have wandered around looking for the Black Aja, but they didn't find any of them. Amiko would have been in the guard room, obviously, and Joya would have been in her bed asleep, because Egwene kept her in Tel Iron Riad with the One Power and her will. Joya was trapped there, and everybody else got away. So we switch to Perrin in Tel Iron Riad, and he syncs up the Rand POV with Rand chasing Ishamael. It says, the halls of the stone were empty, lamps burning, tapestries and weapons hanging on the walls, but nothing moved except himself and Hopper. Except I think that was Rand. It had only been a glimpse, a man running as if chasing someone. It could not be him. It couldn't, but I think it was. And then Perrin finds Faeil finally, and he uses three hammer blows to break down some doors, and he has this very gory falling action scene where all of these falcons shred him to pieces before he's able to break the hedgehog and bring himself and Faeil back to the waking world. And then it goes to Rand. And it says, Rand was still in the heart of the stone, but it was different. There were no men fighting here, no dead men, no one at all but himself. Abruptly the sound of a great gong rang through the stone. Then again, and the very stones beneath his feet resonated. A third time the booming came, but cut off abruptly as if the gong had shattered. All was still. Where is this place? He wondered. More important, where is Baal-Zamon? As if to answer him, a blazing shaft like the one Moraine had made shot out of the shadows among the columns straight toward his chest. His wrist twisted the sword instinctively. It was instinct as much as anything else that made him loose flows from Sidene into Kalendor, a flow of the power that made the sword blaze brighter even than that bar streaking at him. His uncertain balance between existence and destruction wavered. Surely that torrent would consume him. The shaft of light struck the blade of Kalendor and parted on its edge, forking to stream past on either side. So in my episode, The Breast of the World, I said that I thought Ishamael had only been using the true power and had stopped using the One Power a long time before. But if Balefire is hitting Kalendor and it's parting on either side, that must mean that Kalendor is made out of Quaendar. And we know that the true power can destroy Quaendar because it's how Rand manages to destroy the Sad bracelets and the Sad necklace when Semirash puts them on him. And so we must conclude that in fact Ishamael has been using the One Power, and that the Balefire he's using on Rand is made of Sidene. But our final climactic scene plays out in Tel Iron Riad, which RJ chooses to do again in two books. He does it in book 5, and I think one of the reasons that he chooses to do it again in The Fires of Heaven, when Robin flees from Rand into Tel Iron Riad, and then Rand chases after him and they fight in the World of Dreams in the palace in Camelon, is because he wanted to do it better. He had his rules ironed out in the World of Dreams, and so he was like, okay, I'm going to do this again, and it's going to be better this time. It's going to have more hard and fast rules, And not only that, but he provides us observers in the form of Nynaeve and Mogedion, so two people who know a lot more about the world of dreams than Rand does, and can provide a much more educated narrative. And after he kills Robin and finishes talking to Nynaeve, Rand actually opens a gateway and steps out of the world of dreams, instead of what happens here at the end of The Dragon Reborn, where he kills Balzamon, and then it says, "And suddenly, Rand was in another Heart of the Stone, surrounded by columns still whole, and fighting men screaming and dying, veiled men and men in breastplates and helmets. Moraine still lay crumpled at the base of a red stone column, and at Rand's feet lay the body of a man, sprawled on his back with a hole burned through the chest. He might have been a handsome man in his middle years, except that where his eyes and mouth should have been were only pits from which rose tendrils of black smoke." So, I feel like if you can't go back and change something like that, where it's like, oh, now that I've actually figured out the logic behind my rules and behind my magic system, that's not how it actually would work. There would have to be a gateway or whatever. Doing it again the way he does at the end of the Fires of Heaven is a clever way to make that good, because it's just a weakness or an inconsistency in the early part of the story, and there's nothing to be done about that, and there's nothing to be ashamed of about it, because that's just how writing works. And if you don't have a hold of your manuscript still, where you can go back and edit and fix and polish and make perfect, then you just have to accept what can't be changed. And I'm the kind of perfectionist where I would just want to curl up in my bed and die thinking about all of my imperfections and inconsistencies if I were writing a multi-volume series, and so I 100% have mad respect for anyone who puts something out, even if there are plot holes and inconsistencies, because what the fuck are you supposed to do if you're publishing in volumes? In The Shadow Rising, it feels like the rules are ironed out. The rules are ironed out in Tel Irandriad. The rules are ironed out in Aiel culture, and it's sort of like, no, the Aiel would never kneel to Rand when he's like, stop, I'm the Dragon Reborn, and everybody falls to their knees. That doesn't happen. The Karakarn is not a Wetlander king. And the rules for the One Power are much more fleshed out and made more consistent. And in the next book, he takes these great main characters that he did this beautiful work developing in this book, and he just expands them and builds upon this foundation that he has laid for them, and they become quite compelling. And in the next book, Rand starts to learn about what it really means to be the dragon. He goes on his main mission. This next book, we go on a new journey, and the world of the Wheel of Time begins to taste much more robust. And for all that there is a notable difference in flavor between the two books, The Dragon Reborn segues very well into The Shadow Rising. RJ leaves us perfectly poised to start the next book. Matt observes in the final chapter. He had seen Rand just once since the night before, striding along a hall with Kalendor in his hand, surrounded by a dozen veiled Aiel, and trailing a cloud of Terrans, a knot of defenders of the stone, and most of the few surviving High Lords. The High Lords at least seemed to think Rand would need them to help him rule the world. The Aiel kept everyone back with sharp looks, though, and spears if need be. So, we don't hear that a lot of the High Lords died in Book 4. I think that's another thing that he just kind of, like, glosses over because it doesn't work for the narrative going forward. And then Matt is asking, hey, are we the people of the dragon? And when Rourke is like, no, we're the people of the dragon, Matt hears about Roydian. And you know that we've heard about Roydian before, but here, at the very end, it's brought up again, and Matt heard the name when they meet Urien in Kinslayer's Dagger during the Great Hunt, but who knows if Matt even remembers that. So this is the first time where we know for sure that he would remember that he hears Roydian. The girls affirm their determination to hunt the Black Aja, so that sets them up to start Book 4. Rand is ruling. Matt hears about Roydian, and then for the final flourish, we tie up this forsaken fuckery that we've had going on throughout this book in the background. We've had five forsaken that were all dealing and scheming, and now two of them are dead. Ishamael is dead and Baelal is dead. Samael is still off in Ilion, minding his own business now that Moraine and everybody fucked off out of his city. Robin's ploy to kill off the girls was foiled by Matt, and he will begin to start beefing with Rand in the next book as Rand starts sending Terran soldiers up into Kyrian to help feed the people during the Civil War, and Robin is like, whoa, I've got interests there. And then Barrelaine comes into the room where Matt and Rourke and Moraine and the three girls are all kind of having their conversation, and she's like, I'm not used to running errands, but this very impressive woman gave me this note, and somehow I found myself running this errand. So she gives the note to Moraine, and it says, listen to this, Moraine said. Luz Theron was mine, he is mine, and he will be mine forever. I give him into your charge to keep for me until I come. It is signed Lanfear. The eyes that I turn that cool gaze on, Mad. And you thought it was done? You were Tavirin, Mad, a thread more crucial to the pattern than most, and the sounder of the horn of Valir. Nothing is done for you yet. They were all looking at him, Nynaeve sadly, Egwene as though she had never seen him before, Elaine as if she expected him to change into someone else. Rourke had a certain respect in his eyes, though Mac could just as soon have done without it, all things considered. Well, of course, he told them, burn me. I understand. I wonder how soon Tom will be fit to travel. Time to run. Maybe Perrin will come with us. You can count on me. And so we're left, knowing where Lanfear stands. Her plan to help Rand survive succeeded very well. He's a ruler now, which makes him more impressive and worthy of being her boyfriend. And she's like, I'm going to be coming for him, just so you know. And we see that Matt is mentally preparing to flee, which he absolutely intends to do, and it is something that he is continuing to struggle with at the start of the next book, where it's like, I want to go, but I can't. You know, I try to say that I want to go, and I can't, because Tavirin is holding hard to keep him in the stone. And it's a pretty brilliant setting of the stage. When I think of the later prologues that RJ has, From the Fires of Heaven on, I always think of those as laying out the board for the book that is to commence, and in a way I think of the ending of The Dragon Reborn as laying out the board for these main characters so that the Shadow Rising can commence. They're perfectly placed and ready to go. Maybe that's why Book 4 doesn't have a prologue. It's set to kick off from the start. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. I'll be off for about 6 weeks while I read and take notes for The Shadow Rising, and while I learn some more skills. I do plan on guesting on both the Way of the Leaf's Tavern Talk next Sunday, August 8th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, with Jess from the Amarylline Study and Master of the Deck for their live stream, and I'm also going to do a collab with Malkier Talks on his show. I expect to be releasing content again before SpoilerCon, which is in Portland, Oregon, the first weekend in October, but I will tell you now that I will be there, just in case I don't. You can find me on Twitter at WarderGray, that's Gray with an E. All of my links are down in the show notes for email, Discord, the Watt Trivia and Games, and the Watt Fandom and Calendar. There's a link to my Patreon if you'd like to support the show and have access to some really cool bonus content. And there is a link to Apple Podcasts. If you could rate and review the show, that would help me out a lot, and I'd really appreciate it. If you know anyone who likes The Wheel of Time and might be interested in a different kind of podcast, please tell them about me. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I'm the Grey Warder, and I briefly considered cosplaying Hedgehog Trap Perrin at next year's DordanCon. I can do a pleather vest and fake beard no problem, but I can't commit to running around yelling Fy-yeel and banging my hammer, because I want people to like me.